Meeting of the Senate Education Committee to order. We want to be able to complete our agenda today, so as people are gathering, I think they're coming in fairly quickly. I'd like to invite...
Madam Chair, before you start, may I...
Yes, Senator Torres-Rae.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I may, I would like to make a friendly request.
Yes.
I'm just very intrigued by this proposal that Senator Hahn is bringing before us, and I say that honestly. And I would very much hope that we have ample time to talk about it and that give the audience who are here, I don't know who is here to speak about, you know, in opposition or in favor. But we have three presentations ahead of the bill, and I am wondering, Madam Chair, if it would be okay to move it a little bit up so that we have a little bit of time to do that. We just have an hour and a half. Or that if you would please make sure that the people who are presenting kind of move quickly, and then we have, I don't know how much time the author and the rest of the members may think is appropriate, but I would like to have an opportunity to have ample discussion on this bill. And I don't know if you want to break it for next time or how do you want to handle it.
Well, Madam Chair, that's why I'm hoping we can get rolling here. And I believe that the folks from the charter schools, that was kind of a carryover from yesterday, can you be relatively brief or concise in your testimony? And Mr. Hartman from the Education Department was a bit of a clarification of that process of application for those authorizers. And if that gets too detailed or there are too many questions, we can put that off as well. But point well taken, and we will allow adequate time for Senator Hahn's bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
So is Ms. Clensing.
Hi, Senators. Welcome. My name is Karen Clensing, and I'm here representing Friends of Education this legislative session. And with me, I have Beth Topolek. No.
Thank you, Senators. Beth Topolek. I'm with Friends of Education.
Thank you.
And I'm going to point you to the handouts that came around today that explains what Friends of Education is. And they've been around for a while. They've been around since 1999, only under a different name, a few name changes. And initially, we're focused on underperforming grade school in North Minneapolis. And in their work with that school, Ascension Grade School saw huge gains when the nonprofit worked with that school. And so, as a result, have gotten more involved in education reform efforts and initiatives and have themselves become an authorizer and have been in the authorization business for how many years?
Since 2004.
Since 2004. And now they authorize 16 schools. They'll be going on 17 schools in the fall. They are going to be up here at the legislative session this year advocating for a number of charter school initiatives as well as some non-charter school initiatives, and you'll see those on the legislative priority sheet front and back. On the first page, you'll see the high-quality charter school authorizers and charter school policy initiatives, and on the back, you'll see they're taking a huge interest in teaching and teacher effectiveness and teacher quality. Friends really believes that innovation is a way for us. There are a lot of good innovations out there, and it's a good way for the state of Minnesota to find more effective means of instruction for students and for communities to organize around new schools that they really believe in. So that's why we're going to be here this year advocating for a number of initiatives that try to open up the field to allow those schools to exist. Additionally, though, there's a real focus at Friends of Education on making sure any innovations that are implemented are based on sound research. It shows they really are successful. And also, when they're not being successful, that those innovations need to be halted on behalf of the kids. that those kids really need to be in a place where the innovation is being successful for them. So Friends has taken a focus also on the accountability piece, that innovation is a means to an end, but not an end in itself. And so you'll see sometimes Friends will depart somewhat from some of where charter schools may be on that page, and sometimes we won't. But that we wanted to be up here to make sure you knew we were a voice for some of the charter school authorizers in the field. In particular, I want to point out on the legislative priorities sheet for charter school authorizers, since that's our focus as of yesterday and today, on the elimination of the $2 million fund balance for nonprofits. The $2 million fund balance was put in there initially when the law was written to make sure that the nonprofit that was going to be taking on the authorization really had the capacity to authorize. So we'll be supporting, and it'll be in some bills that'll come before you, the elimination of that $2 million fund balance, because now we have a different process, and that process is for authorizers to go through a very rigorous approval process with the department to make sure they meet standards that are high-quality standards for authorizers. With that there, the $2 million fund balance is no longer necessary. We do have some nonprofits out in the field right now will no longer be able to authorize, because with the market where it's at, you can imagine their asset balances have diminished along with a lot of the wallets in our own pockets. So yet they're still doing good work with our schools, and it doesn't make sense that if they're going to go through and be able to pass a rigorous process that they shouldn't be able to continue to authorize. So there are a number of initiatives there, and we know you're in a hurry today. We just wanted to make sure that you knew that we were up here this year to talk about charter schools and to make sure that we're maintaining a good level of accountability in charters. That's really the job of legislators, is to find that sweet spot between innovation and allowing us to be on the edge of the innovation in schools, and yet not put our children in a position where they're not achieving on a daily basis. And so we want to help in that dialogue to find that sweet spot with you as we look at all the different legislative policies that come forward this year.
Thank you, Ms. Klensing. And Ms. Topol, are you interested in testifying, or?
I'm just here to answer questions if there are.
Are there any questions of the representatives of Friends of Education? Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one quick question, Ms. Klensing. Does it take legislation to allow the authorizers to review the student performance data? Is that something that could be set up through the authorizers themselves?
Ms. Klensing?
So right now the law only allows educational entities to look at those and the student-level performance data, and authorizers are not considered an educational entity, so they would need to be added to that list in order to review that data. They can review some more aggregated data that's anonymized. The problem with that is they're not able to track one student through a system K-8. They can only look at really cohorts of systems that way. It's much more difficult. They have to get data agreements on a regular basis, and if you've got 16 schools, you'd have to go through the Department of Education or the school district to do that every single time. And if an authorizer is using that for purposes of checking to see if the school is making progress, then the school may or may not be interested in doing that data agreement with the authorizer who's holding them accountable.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions? If not, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Piccolo. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Eugene Piccolo, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of Charter Schools. Madam Chair and members, first, I appreciate the opportunity to take a few minutes to share some perspectives on some issues regarding charter schools. First, I want to thank you all again, this committee's work over the last few years in terms of charter school law. The result of the work done 2 years ago led to Minnesota having been named having the best charter school law in the United States now for 2 years in a row. And we're very proud of the fact that even though other states have made strides in their law, we continue to be ranked number one in the country. While our law is the best in the nation, we do constantly need to update it to meet new challenges, new understandings, and new lived practices of charter schooling. And in that vein, we'll be proposing a series of amendments this year, some around authorizing and eligibility. We support the elimination of the $2 million limit. We support the idea of raising the number of single-purpose authorizers. We will have some language about the transfer of authorizers, which has been one of the issues that we have faced the last year. We will have some language about the mergers of charter schools, which has occurred once, and now there are a couple other schools where there might be some looking at mergers. And also clarification of the role of authorizers versus the department in terms of expansions and so forth. To really, now that we have put more responsibility on authorizers, to clarify that the role in the commissioner and the department in some circumstances should be advise, comment, and review rather than the final decision. So we have some proposals in that vein. So we will have language that is being drafted right now on these issues and some other issues, technical changes to clarify the law. But beyond these policy and technical changes, I do want to address a few bigger issues that revolve around charter schools. And the first is charter school facilities. 2 years ago, this committee recognized affiliated building companies for the first time under law. This was a legitimate way of doing business, because one of the concerns that charter schools have had is finding facilities for their program. Last year, then, this committee also spent an extraordinary amount of time in that issue and developed a comprehensive proposal that would have created a new framework for providing for charter school facilities. While it was not enacted, we believe that it provided a pretty solid framework for addressing the issue going forward. And while we believe this issue needs to again be addressed at some point, if not this year, hopefully next year, and we are committed to working to find a comprehensive solution around that issue of facilities. In the meantime, we would request the committee consider amending the lease aid law to give charter schools leverage in negotiating with landlords by creating an incentive to reduce facility costs. Currently, landlords have the upper hand in negotiations because they know exactly how much a school will get in terms of lease aid per student, and that it can only be spent on lease costs. So guess how much all leases are in this state. We propose that a charter school that can negotiate a lower lease cost than the per pupil lease aid be able to keep 50% of the difference in the for the school program, and the other 50% would be savings to the state treasury. An incentive of this kind does three things. It reduces the costs for leasing of space. It puts more money in the classroom without costing the state any new money. And third, it actually saves the state some money. We believe in these tight times that it is a proposal that should be a no-brainer, as it is a win for students, the school, and the state. The last thing I want to address is the growing disparity in funding between charter schools and traditional charter schools and traditional district schools. Last summer, Ball State University, Muncie, Indiana, conducted the second national study on charter school and district finances. And while Minnesota ranks well in comparison to other states, the study showed that the disparity in funding between charter schools and traditional districts was 13% in 2007. And the gap had grown significantly from the previous study in 2001, when the gap in disparity was 8%. In St. Paul, that disparity was even higher than the statewide average at 13.4%. And in Minneapolis, the disparity between funding for charter schools and the district is even greater at 21%. So why the disparity, and why is it growing? There are at least three simple answers for that.
One, as the state has become more reliant on property taxes, the greater the disparity, since charter schools cannot levy taxes. Second, there have been changes in the overall funding formula for education that over the years, charter schools got a percentage of operating levy referendum equalization, but that has dropped over the years and will completely disappear within the next 2 years. Third, again, with the overall changes made to funding of education, charter school students are no longer receiving any funding from the permanent school fund. Since the funding was changed from being incorporated in the basic formula to being in addition to the basic revenue formula. So the disparity is growing in terms of funding for charter school, public school students, and district school students. We asked that the charter school students receive the full amount of local referendum operating revenue that is generated for those students. Districts count those charter school students in their referendum, but are not providing the education for them. So we would ask that that funding be follow the child. Second, we would ask the legislature rectify the exclusion of charter schools from funding from the permanent school fund. Third, we would ask support for finding a means to assist charter schools in getting access to low-interest loans that many schools need as a result of the 30% holdback. The impact on charter schools is much greater because districts have the ability to use their property tax as collateral for low-interest loans, and charters do not since they cannot issue property taxes. So banks and lenders are charging much higher interest rates to charter schools for these short-term loans. Interest rate is as high as 20% because there's no collateral backing for these loans because of the shift. And finally, I want to mention compensatory education and some proposals being considered to change the formula from concentration to a flat per pupil. We understand the philosophical arguments that are made in each matter of funding, but we want you to know that charter schools are serving twice the state average of low-income kids, many of whom are in demographic groups with the biggest achievement gaps in the state. A shift from the poverty concentration formula to a flat rate system would increase the disparity in funding between charter schools and traditional districts by another $18 million on a statewide basis a year. So again, we ask your support and consideration, and we look forward to working with you in making adjustments to the charter school law during the session.
Thank you, Mr. Piccolo. Are there any questions of members? Now, thank you. I know you're around, and we'll be hearing from you again. Thank you very much. And Mr. Hartman from the department is going to follow up with a bit more on the authorizer process, I believe. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the opportunity to address some of the questions that were raised yesterday and to give some context to the authorizer approval and review process that the department has been conducting since last year.
Give your name and position for the record.
I apologize. My name is Dave Hartman from the Minnesota Department of Education. I'm the acting supervisor of the Charter Schools Center.
Thank you. Mr. Hartman.
So there's a handout that will be coming around to accompany this, but just to give some context to how the department has proceeded relative to the changes of law. So prior to 2009, authorizers were considered sponsors, and the two entry points for oversight of sponsors for the department were just in terms of eligibility, which was the type of the organization rather than anything having to do with quality. And then secondly, sponsors were required to produce an end-of-contract evaluation for every charter school in which they oversaw. In 2009, the legislature responded to performance and accountability concerns in charter schools and used the National Association of Charter School Authorizers' Principles and Standards of Quality Charter School Authorizing to make the changes in the charter school law and those expectations of charter school authorizers. And basically, it charged the department to, and the commissioners specifically, to establish criteria for that approval process based on capacity and infrastructure, application criteria and process, contracting process, ongoing oversight and evaluation processes, and renewal criteria and processes. So following spring of 2009 and going into the winter of 2010, the department crosswalked the charter law against these principles and standards and established an application for authorizers, which was first produced and made public of February of 2010. So every application is reviewed by three reviewers, one national, one Minnesota, and one MDE reviewer. And they conduct a desk review against these expectations that are identified against the state law and the quality, the NAAQS's principles and standards. The desk review that's conducted is brought together, and then the authorizers who submit the application follow through with an interview with those reviewers where they ask clarifying questions. The evaluation results of that review are brought forward to the commissioner for a final approval or denial. So in the first round of authorizer application reviews, so those submissions were due at the end of March last year, there were 13 applications that were reviewed. Six were approved by the commissioner. And basically the biggest difference in the characteristics between the approved and the denied were against sections 2, 3, 4, and 5 of those characteristics identified. So application criteria, contracting process, ongoing oversight and evaluation processes, and renewal criteria processes. So those who were denied did not have their procedures aligned with those that were approved. The second round of applications, which were last fall, submissions were due in September, and reviews were in October and November, with decisions in December. There were 16 applications that were reviewed. Nine were approved by the commissioner. Three of those nine that were approved were previously denied authorizers who improved their applications based on the feedback from the first round. And the biggest difference between the rounds approved and denied applicants was in the first section, mission, vision, capacity, and infrastructure. And so these organizations had not demonstrated effectively against the reviewers' evaluation that they were in place to conduct their authorizer expectations in a way that were effective and high quality and met the state standard. The third round of authorizer applications are due today. We anticipate anywhere between 12 and 20 applications for the remaining 30 or so authorizers who are not approved. And to reflect some of what Gene Piccolo had to say, the National Alliance of Public Charter Schools, in their annual review of charter school laws, recognized Minnesota's charter law as the strongest in the nation. And actually, it bumped up from number 2 last year to number 1 this year based upon these changes in oversight of authorizers. So I appreciate the opportunity to share some of this information and welcome any questions.
Are there any questions left over from yesterday? So, Mr. Chair, the reflecting on some of the conversation yesterday, these standards and quality, they will be, they're under the essentially the jurisdiction or the authority of the organization of charter school authorizers that are writing their own standards. And I presume, I think part of the issue that I was, that there was some concern reflected in it, you have an outside entity establishing the criteria. You know, we have put in statute at one point in time, they might change or adjust to them, and it was appearing that you were using them as a standard versus being any limitation that the statute would provide. I don't know if I'm stating that clearly or not, or if that change would drive how you would handle the application process, or whether we should in fact be addressing it more clearly in statute.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Hartman.
To that, we know that those principles and standards were relied upon to formulate this, the current statute, and used them to help identify what the expectations would be in the application. However, we're not bound to those changes that that organization makes. We've adopted the application and rely upon that and base it all against what's in statute. Very clearly, it's footnoted throughout the entire application. Very clearly, so any of the applicants can look at that information. If the organization revises those principles and standards, we have no obligation to respond to that. Especially if it deviates from state law.
Thank you. Any further questions? If not, thank you very much, Mr. Hartman. We know where to find you, and if there are further questions on these issues, I know we'll be hearing from you again.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And I think we've arrived at Senator Hand. We're waiting to hear your bill, Senate File 203. Senator Hand.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about our bill, Senate File 203. Briefly, and I got a couple of people that want to testify in favor of the bill. I don't know if there's anybody testifying in opposition to it. But let me try to just walk through a little bit what the bill is intending to accomplish. First, it's important to note that we do provide in Minnesota for early graduation from high school. That's something that has been longstanding. Students who complete requirements early may graduate early. What the first section of the bill points to is amending that a little bit. Under the current statutes, if a student graduates early, the funding for that student would continue to go to the school district where they were in attendance. So even though the student has left, the funding would still be in the student's high school or home district. This proposes to change that by saying that that would happen unless the early graduate participates in the scholarship program defined in the bill. Section 2 talks about what the early graduation achievement scholarship program, what it is. Essentially, if a student graduates early, they're eligible for a scholarship in incremental amounts of $2,500, depending on how early they complete the requirements for graduation. So the amount of the, grant could be as high as $7,500 if they graduate three or more semesters or five or more trimesters early. So the maximum would be $7,500 grant. This grant could be used at any accredited college. It's not required that the student attend a Minnesota-based institution, but any accredited college in the country. It does require that the student verify their enrollment, of course, before they'd be eligible to receive the grant. It doesn't require that the student leave high school and immediately enroll in college. So it's possible that a student could graduate and then enroll in college a year from graduation or a year from leaving the high school and still be eligible for the grant. The money that would be supplying the grants would be the money that would be saved from the funding that would go to the home district in the event that the student remained in the district. So the trade-off is that as a student leaves a school district early, that money would be retained by the state, and part of that money would then be used to fund the grant program to the students who enrolled early in college or in higher education. The Section 3 of the bill also is a slight change from current practice, where it says that under current practice, a student who graduates early, the school district may use some of the funds that that student would ordinarily have brought to the district to fund early all-day kindergarten program. And this would just say that except for the students who have participated in the early graduation scholarship program. That essentially is the structure of the bill. And I do have a couple of Jim Bartholomew has indicated he would like to testify, and I believe there's somebody from the Minnesota Council of Gifted and Talented who would also like to testify. And so, Madam Chair, I don't know if you want to take questions right now or wait for some further testimony.
Senator Han, I would just, in reading this on page 2, line 20, where it says the general education money is transferred, you're transferring it to fund the early graduation achievement scholarships from the general ed aid appropriation for that year. Where are you transferring it to? I haven't noticed it. Is there a special fund created for those scholarships or?
Madam Chair, no, there's not a special fund. I think what is anticipated is that there would be a person at the department. In fact, the fiscal note anticipates some administrative cost that is included in the fiscal note. And then the money would be transferred directly to the institution that has accepted the student. When that time comes, Madam Chair, that's correct.
Thank you.
I don't think there's anticipation of a pool that would be created from which these funds would be drawn, but it would be drawn out of current appropriated monies out of the general ed fund.
Thank you. If it goes beyond 1 year, but it would accumulate for that student, I presume, or is it accumulating for a fund? Because you're predicting it will actually save money for the state, so the amount that would be put aside would just be the amount that is designated in the bill.
Madam Chair, yes. I think what the fiscal note anticipates is that there would be savings from not having to pay the general fund amounts to the school districts because the pupil would be gone. So that money would not be paid. And instead, that money, or at least a portion of that money, would be used to fund the scholarship grant. It also would pay for the cost of an additional person at the department to administer the program. And that's what the fiscal note tries to walk through that. If you look on page 7, I think, of the fiscal note, it sort of runs through a chart and talks about the savings and then the costs, and the net savings amounts to about, the first year, $1.4 million.
Very good. Thank you. Senator Bonha.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Han, could you just talk a little bit about your intention behind the bill, and just so I have a clear understanding? And then you did not choose to put anything about achievement in here, so you're thinking about that with regard to what if a student, you know, just graduates early by just loading up on classes that aren't rigorous. I mean, I assume we still have our standards, so perhaps I wouldn't be able to do that, but just explore both of those.
Madam Chair and Senator Bonhoff, thank you. Yes, my experience is that there are a number of students today who participate in PSEO and other kinds of college prep or pre-college or maybe even early college participation. And I think most of the students that do this are students that are recognized as high-achieving students. Students are highly motivated. And I believe that this is, and if the fiscal note sort of assumes that as well in its assumptions, that this is the pool of students that are likely to be the early graduators. And so I think the requirements that we have in place for graduation would still be in place. And so the achievement issue would be that do you have somebody that can pass the coursework required by our law currently and do so early and also be admitted to a college or institution of higher education? I guess the assumption is that you're not talking about students that are at the minimum level of achievement, but probably students that are pretty highly motivated to do this. I think the other thing is that we've talked a lot about, and I remember even back in the years I was on the school board in Eden Prairie, the senior year oftentimes for all students is kind of a time for slacking off, or, you know, a lot of students, they kind of work real hard through the junior year, and then they maybe take their tests and they choose their colleges, and then they sort of take the time off. And I've even heard people talk about the senior year as being sort of a waste for many students. They're not really focused. They're not really working too hard. Part of this is to perhaps put some more motivation into students to say, look, keep working. And if you work hard and get done early, then you don't have to just pass the time at high school. Go off and do the next thing. So I think it may help retain the high degree of focus that you want on some of the higher achieving students that right now might be just kind of taking the year off their senior year, and instead encouraging them to continue to work hard and perhaps start college a little bit early because there's a financial incentive for them to gain a scholarship if they do that. And so I hope that it would actually improve our ability to have college-ready students leaving high schools and going into college. Not all of them, but the ones that are already motivated would encourage them to do so and keep that up. So I don't know if that fully answers your concern,
yep,
but that was
Thank
kind
you.
Of what I had in mind. Mm-hmm.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Hahn, certainly these are great things, incentivizing post-secondary education and saving the state money at the same time. Sounds like a great winning opportunity there. But I do have one question for you, and it has to do with the fact that the scholarships are not required at Minnesota institution attendance. And I believe, like, our state grant program requires that our taxpayer dollars be used for attendance at a Minnesota institution, not necessarily a public one, could be a private one, but it is in the state of Minnesota. And so I'm sure you've given this great thought, but I'd like to kind of hear your thoughts about that. And then are there any other cases where we take taxpayer dollars from the state of Minnesota and we don't require for education that they be used in the state of Minnesota?
Senator Hahn.
Madam Chair and Senator Nelson, I guess it's the will of the committee if you want to change that provision. I was silent on that in this bill under the thought that our goal is to encourage students to choose and to be enrolled in an institution of higher education. And there may be students who have a choice from an institution some other place. I don't want to preclude their ability or their desire to do that. I think that because this is a net saving to the state, that I'm looking at it as it doesn't really matter where they attend college because the net effect is the state saves money. I understand that there's maybe a interest in wanting to promote colleges in Minnesota, but I'm willing to allow students to make that choice if the idea is to make sure you have motivated students and someone is really motivated, let's say, to go off to Marquette University or Iowa State or something, if that's really where they want to go, and we say, well, if you do this and you're motivated to do it, but you can't go to the school you want to go to, I look at that as maybe an impediment to their motivation. So I would rather, let's see if we can motivate students to stay focused, work hard. If they can achieve a scholarship, then let them take the scholarship where they think they'll get the best opportunity that they're looking for. So that's really the reason, but I'm certainly happy to listen to the will of the committee if you'd like to change that.
Just a follow-up, Madam Chair.
Senator Nelson.
So I understand the intent, a good intent. I guess my question is, is there anything else like this where we use state taxpayer dollars for education but not in the state of Minnesota? I don't know, and I don't know if it would cause a problem if we did. I'm just asking.
Madam Chair and Senator Nelson, I guess I don't know offhand if we do or not. I do know there are some other states that do similar things, Texas, Utah, and Arizona, but I also don't know whether they limit their scholarship to schools within their state or not. I really don't know that.
Madam Chair, I'd like to know if those...
Senator Nelson, we had reciprocity with some states, and so I think there already is some arrangements where that might go elsewhere. Senator Torres-Wray?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Hahn, you might be interested in knowing that I have a 17-year-old, and he's in 11th grade, and his two cousins are graduating in different countries this year. So he's very jealous about it. And a year ago, he asked me why is that he couldn't go live in these countries where he can finish earlier. And during the summer, we explored the possibility so that he can start college next year instead of going to 12th grade. And we found out that he doesn't have trigonometry and chemistry 2, and the only requirement that he will meet in order to graduate now is second language because he spoke fluent English. So that was out of the door. But in the process, we were kind of intrigued with this idea, and we were asking questions around some of the requirements for college for people who are under 18. Because apparently for housing purposes and some registration processes, you have to be 18. So I don't know if anybody has contacted you about it. I was just curious about, I think the idea is very intriguing. I think that we're going to have a lot of competition, and in fact, a lot of kids who should be graduating earlier might see an incentive to do better and graduate earlier. So I'm intrigued about that, although in the past I've thought that maybe we would be leaving some kids behind that are not achieving. My sense is that this will give them an opportunity to think that they will be getting out of school quickly, and that might be a motivation. So it's a very intriguing idea. But are you aware, or do we know about some of the requirements in higher education that may impede the entrance to college right away? I don't know.
Senator Hand.
Madam Chair and Senator Torres-Ray, I personally do not know of any impediments to having a student enter college before age 18. I know I spent my first year in college before I was age 18, but that was some time ago, so I don't know if things have changed since then. But I don't know of any. That's an interesting question. I had not thought about that, frankly, to wonder if that's a problem. I am aware that there are, and some very notable, there are young people who've gone off to college. You hear about these kids that are geniuses and they're 13 years old or something, and so there must be a way to do it. I don't know if it presents unique problems. I certainly would think that if a person who was, say, 16 and was able to accumulate the graduate courses needed and do well enough to get out of high school early, that there might be some concern on the part of a college of, well, do we accept a young student, and what might be some of those concerns? And, in fact, parents might have some concern about, well, do I want to send my 16-year-old off to another state, perhaps, or at least another city to live alone at age 16? I think those are all questions. I'm not sure that there's any things that I'm aware of from an institutional perspective that would say this couldn't be done, although I agree it may present some problems that might need to be at least thought about on the behalf of the families and perhaps the institutions as well. But I don't have a clear answer for that. That's a good question.
Madam Chair?
Senator Nino.
Madam Chair, I'm young enough to have been in college, and we had some PSEO students living on campus in a residential situation. So, and particularly in Minnesota, anyway, it was a Minnesota college. Minnesota colleges have become accommodating because of the PSEO program and because of home education, where children are graduating early via that route. So they have become, in Minnesota anyway, I can't speak to other states, but they have become much more accommodating because that's a clientele that they want to bring in.
Great. Now, you've had some testifiers, so.
Madam Chair, yes, I'd like to. Jim Bartholomew from the Business Partnership had indicated an interest in testifying, and I believe there was someone
I think right behind you is ready to come, so why don't you join Senator Hand at the table and share your testimony.
Hi, Madam Chair. I'm Tina Armstrong, and I am the current president of the Minnesota Council for Gifted and Talented. MCGT is a statewide nonprofit support and advocacy organization for gifted students. And our membership comes from parents, educators, and other professionals. We've actually been around for 65 years this year. So it is a long-term dedication that Minnesota has had to our state's gifted and talented students. MCGT is very supportive of this bill, very supportive of an early graduation achievement scholarship program. We see it as a complement to things we're already doing here. We've got requirements that the legislature passed in 2007 to have acceleration policies in every school district. And acceleration is something that doesn't have to cost extra money. It's just kind of reallocating resources, putting students in a situation where they're learning at their level. And this is really just an extension of that. Some of the best research out of Gifted and Talented has come out of Minnesota. So what I did on my handout is we got some prior indicators of student success in early entrance to college. And what you're going to see in that little footnote there is it came out of Karen Rogers, who's a professor at the University of St. Thomas. So early entrance to college, it's got to be the right kid. And it's certainly, there's a number of programs here that works, and this would give families one other choice. Post-secondary enrollment options in Minnesota, it's up to the college what the kids can take for classes. Oftentimes with PSEO students, they'll limit them to one class in the term or have a picked list that the PSEO students have to choose from. So this really, for the kid that's kind of outside of that list, Mine was lucky that the U of M let him take avian science and educational psychology. But that's not necessarily what's available at all the different colleges. So PSEO has its limitations there, and they always pick their classes last through the PSEO students. AP and IB, that's great for the high-achieving, gifted and talented student who really loves that academic rigor and that type of thing. But when you've got the non-conventional gifted student who's kind of out of the box and kind of resistant to strict curriculum, that's not necessarily the right program for them. So this is just giving families one other choice where it's right for them. So that is why we are supportive of this bill. And by the way, my son graduated at 16 just a couple years ago, and he is at Hamline, so he did stay in the state.
Thank you, Ms. Armstrong. Are there any questions for Ms. Armstrong? And Jim Bartholomew.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members. Jim Bartholomew with the Minnesota Business Partnership. And you've already had some great testimony, and you have a copy of a letter from us in support of this proposal. So I'll just be quick, and again, we support this bill as a way to continue to help create a seamless transition for kids into and through higher education. And actually, I thought that going through materials, I thought this was as good a quote as I could come up with, and I'll be quick. Graduating early from high school provides today's students with more options. They can take advantage of a variety of post-secondary and career offerings sooner. As a high school teacher for 23 years, I know that many of my students would have benefited from the new models that are emerging in states today. It's kind of neat that this is the 25th anniversary of the Post-Secondary Enrollment Options Act, and it's wonderful that the state is still working to try and help students advance. And this is just another one of those wonderful efforts, and the quote was from the president of the NEA.
So. Great. Thank you very much. Are there others out here that would like to testify on behalf of it or in opposition to it?
Madam Chair.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one follow-up, maybe Mr. Bartholomew or Senator Hand. Actually, it's a great concept, by the way. Fantastic. Do we need anything in Subdivision 5 about the length of time in which they can make this request? If somebody were out for 5 years or 10 years, I'm just curious about the time line and what you anticipate there.
Do you want to? Senator Hand, get it quickly, Madam Chair.
Mr. Bartholomew.
Nelson. There was in another committee testimony about how it was nice not to have specific timelines in there. There was a testimony given by a young person about how they were part of a family business. It helped them to get through high school early to secure these financial resources. They worked in the family business, I think, for a year or two. But then when things settled down, they were able to enroll in a higher ed institution and then access the scholarship funds. So having that flexibility was a real benefit for that individual. And just quickly to your earlier comment about in-state, got a daughter in school up in Duluth, and a lot of people go to Superior and the Grand Forks area, and so there may be some reasons to keep those options open as well.
Thank you.
And Madam Chair, can I respond as well? Yes. Senator Nelson.
Senator Hand.
Thank you. I think, too, that one of the things that may happen is you may have students who graduate early, start college early, but may not apply for the additional scholarship money until their junior or senior year in college. And all I'm looking for is, I think, maximum flexibility on the part of the student when they might want to take advantage of using these funds. Since we've never tried this before, I don't know if it creates a problem to have sort of a potential obligation out there, but as long as the requirement is that they verify not only that they graduated early, but also that they're involved or enrolled in an accredited college, I think if we do this and we find out that it creates a problem, then we may want to come back and revisit that and say, well, let's try to put some time frame on the use of this thing. But at this point, because of the experimental nature, I guess, of this, I would prefer to leave it to be flexible and see what kind of experience we see. And if we need to make changes, we can revisit that.
Madam Chair, on that subject.
Thank you, Senator Bonham.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Hahn, the part of the statute that this amends also talks about that in the past, when a student graduated early, a district had the option of absorbing some of those funds for pre-K and early childhood. So my concern about leaving it open-ended is, what if the district, if they don't know that the student is going to use those funds, they've already absorbed them, and then we wouldn't have them available. Is it possible, or would you consider, and maybe it's already in there and I've missed it, but at a student, at least when they graduate early, to state their intent of will they be using it, not that they have to use it right away, so that the money is, and I see Dr. Melcher's here. I don't know if he's considered that problem, but I'm concerned about the timing of the funds.
Senator Hahn?
Madam Chair and Senator Bonhoff, that's a good question. I know we talk about that if the student is participating in the program, then those funds have to be, set aside from the use of the school. Otherwise, they are retained by the school. I suppose if a student took early graduation and didn't make a statement to the effect that they were going to use those funds, then we would continue to provide them to the local school. And then if later that student said, well, now I want to use the funds, I guess that could present an issue.
But Senator Hahn, that was part of my point earlier on page 2, line 20, that the commissioner must transfer the amounts necessary. That's the commissioner of education must transfer the amounts necessary to fund these scholarships from the general education appropriation for that year. Transfer them where? Does it go to the district, and are they managing this, or is the state keeping them in some type of set aside? It's not a clear direction as to how that is managed, and I don't know if Dr. Melcher has had a chance to review that. If in terms of how that's managed, how those funds are managed, he may have some suggestion on that. Unless I'm missing something here, but.
Madam Chair, are you looking for a comment from Dr. Melcher?
Well, either you or Dr. Melcher. I think
I'll
in
defer
response
to Dr. Melcher. He's the
Senator
expert.
Senator Bonhoff's question was referring, it looks like it's a school responsibility. I'm not sure that it's clear that it is. It looks like it might be a state one. They're transferring it, but where?
Madam Chair and members, my name
Dr.
is Tom Melcher.
Melcher
with the Department of Education. I think there are some technical kinds of things that need to be worked out here. The indication is that the school district keeps the money unless the student participates. So there would be an issue if the student didn't participate in the first year. Presumably, you'd pay the money to the school district, and then we'd have to make a negative adjustment down the road to get it back if they participated 2 years 2 years later. So there are some. There are some issues in terms of timing and planning that I think could be helpful. If the participation is relatively low, it's probably not going to have a huge impact on a school district's budget, but it does. There are some things that maybe need a little further work in terms of making them work smoothly administratively.
Thank you, Dr. Melcher. Senator Torres-Ray?
Thank you. And Senator Hahn, with respect to this, I know it's early and probably you will continue to work on this, but that I think is a very key issue. With respect to, if schools have a high volume of students who will be leaving, they will be losing money, then other districts, so there will be an imbalance. And so it will be, I think, an opportunity to think about, how do you create a mechanism through which the state benefits as a whole. Those districts that may have, high volume of students and then they are all leaving, or those that do not have that, and how do you balance that, I think, would be an important conversation because that fund, will have to stay in place for the future of education for all kids. And I don't know how to predict what is going to happen, but it obviously, you know, districts that have, you know, high volume of high achievers will be seeing rivers of kids leaving early, and that's kind of inconvenient for their budget, although it's convenient for the kids and the families. And then the others who have the opposite will also be will see a different trend, the opposite trend. So I think that figuring out that formula will be, I think, an important step. I don't know how yet, but it's just an important question, I think.
Mr. Kite, do you want to respond to that first?
Well, Madam Chair, I guess I want to make a comment. I think the question about how to handle the timing of this, since the bill is silent on when the student would be eligible to use the funding and what that might mean in, as far as transferring the money or doing negative transfers, as Dr. Melcher talked about. I think that we should try to address that, and I had not anticipated doing that before today, so I think we need to try to find a way to do that, at least address that as a potential issue of how that would be done. But to Senator Torres-Rae, I think the question about if we do this and it turns out there are schools that have a pretty significant number of students that are graduating early, what that might suggest is the school district itself is doing a wonderful job, and it may, if they lose the students, maybe it becomes an attraction for open enrollment into their school as a way to encourage other students to say, well, this looks like a school where if our student goes there, they're likely to be able to graduate early, and so maybe it's an opportunity for the school district to attract additional students to come into their district. I don't know. But I think until we do this for a little bit and see what kind of experience we get, I do think that we're not talking about large numbers. The fiscal note assumed, I think, what did they? They had a number in their projection that was relatively small. Less than 200 students, I think, in the first year. I'm trying to find out here on the, I'm not locating it here. So I think the anticipation is that there are not a lot of kids that would take advantage of this, at least in the early going. So it may not create a huge problem, at least initially. But I do think, I can't see it here as I'm scanning quickly, but maybe on the top of page 7, it has 270, I guess, in the first year, 270 students statewide, and then it increases from there according to the assumptions. But I do think that it would make sense for us to try to address the problem of how do you handle the question of if a student is eligible but doesn't immediately take the funding, how do we deal with that? And I think what I would like to do is see if I can talk with the department, perhaps, and work out some language that might accommodate that and offer that as an amendment.
Thank you very much, sure. Senator Hand and Mr. Kite.
I'm Charlie Kite. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of School Administrators. Thank you for allowing me to speak. Just briefly, we're not speaking either for or against this bill right now. It's just kind of informational, a couple things to just put into consideration. I think if you're going to move the bill forward, you might want to, you'll be wanting to think these along with a few other things out. One is, I think the supposition here is that the student who is going to graduate early is a very, very top-end academic student. But that may not just be the case. Students can complete their graduation requirements taking very rigorous education or not such a rigorous education. So you might want to consider that the bill would actually say that this is for students who are college-ready, proficient, that have taken a rigorous academic program. Secondly, it hits me that even along those lines, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, Mr. Kite, I was just going to say, or you could say that the funds are not eligible, remedial courses would not be eligible for the use of the
I actually was, Senator Olson, I was actually thinking about that. I thought we could also say, well, you know, they can't use it for remedial courses, because if you're using it for remedial courses, you probably shouldn't have been leaving high school early anyway. Second thing that I just point out is that right now, if a student graduates early in their junior year, let's say halfway through the year, the school district keeps the state aid for the full year. And that's this aid that would kind of be going to that scholarship program. If a student graduates a full year early at the end of their junior year, the school district doesn't collect any aid whatsoever in the senior year. So I think you have to be careful on the fiscal note to be sure you're not sort of thinking about saving this money for a student graduating a full year early when there's no money to be saved in the first place because it's never paid to the school. And I didn't have time to study the fiscal note quite close enough to understand that. But if they graduate half a year early, or if they graduate 1.5 years early, the district now gets the money for that full year. But if it's just at the end of the 11th grade, then we don't collect the money for the next year. That's a technical point, but you need to think that through. And finally, if this idea takes off, and I think it actually, you know, has some merit, and if it takes off, and we're not talking about 270 students, and we're talking about 5,000 students, one of the issues that the schools have to deal with, the high schools, is that we have quite a number of students that most likely will be leaving the second half of the year. And yet, right now, under all of our contracts, we employ people for a full year. And you could see where you would need maybe one allocation of faculty for the first half of the year and a slightly smaller allocation for the second half of the year. So you almost want to give the school some ability to be able to make that adjustment if this is significant. If it's tiny, you know, we work with it. So those are just some thoughts that maybe can go into the hopper as you move this bill forward.
Thank you, Mr. Kite. It looked like Dr. Melcher had some comment related to that testimony.
Madam Chair and members, Tom Melcher with the Department of Education. I just wanted to comment on the construction of the fiscal note and the issue that Dr. Kite raised. On the bottom of page 5 of the fiscal note, you'll see an example of how we calculated pupil unit savings under the fiscal note. And you see it shows fiscal year 2012 ADM saved, or the reduction in ADM. And you'll see that there's an assumption here that we've got 347 students who are graduating one semester early. We're saving 174 ADM on those. The students who are graduating two semesters early, you'll see we're assuming there's 83 of those, but none of them are generating any savings because there is no savings. And then the three semesters early, they're generating savings on that second semester of their junior year. So that is an important issue that Dr. Kite raised. It is properly accounted for in the fiscal note.
Thank you. Well, I think Mr. Kite left, so there is no possibility of asking me any questions, Senator Wieger.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Just a few thoughts, unless there's other testimony.
I am not aware. Is there any further testimony on the one way or the other? Senator Wieger.
Okay, Madam Chair, I like the concept and appreciate your coming forward with it, and just in terms of weighing in, I was thinking what Kurt Johnson was saying in the testimony yesterday, and in terms of, you know, what grade you're in and that, and I don't know if we'll have those distinctions a generation from now, but when we can look at incentives to graduate early, if you have mastered what we've asked, congratulations, mission accomplished. And having an incentive, I think, is a very good idea. I think initially we should remember there's a lot of very good activities that students are incentivized to participate, particularly in extracurricular activities, sports or non-sports, and it's a very fulfilling year as well, notwithstanding senior slide. I think on some specifics that a person should be a Minnesota resident, and I'm okay with going to a reciprocity college on the border or where there's reciprocity, but I think you should be Minnesota. I don't think you should get that graduation gift and be able to leave the state as a non-resident. Just a thought. With, you know, Minnesota taxpayers are issuing that. The rigor expectations, Senator Bonoff initially, you know, had asked, and Dr. Kite had also asked about what is that threshold, the expectation. And I think putting in something that on college ready, and we do have tests, whether it's the Accuplacer used by Minscu or the university, the ACT that they'll look at, but it says you are not going to have writing, reading, or math remediation. And I wouldn't just say you can't use the money for that. To me, I would argue you're not college or career ready if we really mean what we say in statute and all the rhetoric. So I would say that, yes, you might graduate early, but you're not going to get that scholarship if you aren't proficient, as evidenced in one of those tests or something else. So those would be my comments.
Okay. Is there anybody else that has any comments or questions? So your Senator Hand?
Madam Chair and members, I guess what I'd like to ask is if you want to retain the bill here for us to think about addressing, in particular, this timing issue, or do you want to allow us to move it on? I don't know if it has to go to any other committees, frankly. Does Higher Ed Committee want to see this? Do you know?
Mr. Chair, I haven't heard anything from them. Sometimes people spot bills that are related and have requested them. I've had that in a couple of cases, but not for this one. I would just suggest we lay it on the table for possible inclusion and in the omnibus bill, and there's time to work on some of these issues, because when we create that, we will be revisiting the issues that we're going to be putting into it.
Well, Madam Chair, I appreciate that, and what I will do in the meantime is see if we can think about some of the issues that have been raised and some language that might address some of the concerns, and add that to the bill when the time comes to adopt it in the full bill.
Yep. Thank you, Senator Hand. I appreciate the thoughtful
Thank
testimony
you.
And discussion that we've had and your response to it. And if there doesn't appear to be anything further on further business before the committee, we will be rewarded once again with a little slightly early adjournment. So the committee is adjourned.
Thank you.